abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, June 23rd, 2014. Doing the show on my own today. I'll give you the topic in just a minute, although I suppose you guys can see the subject line for the show, but I'll pretend there's some suspense going on here. Last week, you guys know because I've been mentioning it over and over again, I went to St. Paul for an event there, an event with the Minnesota Tea Party Alliance. And these were great people. There were a lot of great Ron Paul folks there, a lot of people who have come to events of mine in the past. I would say Texas and Minnesota are the two states that have invited me to speak more than any others. And then there were a lot of people in the room who were completely unfamiliar with me, but by the time I was done, every book I had was flying off the table, so it was a very successful event. But it didn't start off that way earlier in the day anyway. My flight was canceled because of bad weather in St. Paul, and there was no other flight I could take. Everything was booked, or it would get me there too late. So I'm frantically looking on my smartphone to try to figure out how long the drive would be, and I found out that it would be just under 7 hours from Kansas City to St. Paul. So I got in my car and drove there. And this was very much appreciated. That I was glad about that. But I thought, I've committed to do this. These people put a lot of energy into preparing this event. And if it's physically possible for me to be there, I'm not going to leave them in the lurch. So I went there, and then I drove all the way back. And that same day that I drove all the way back, I had to take my family to Oklahoma for a surprise party for my father-in-law. So we drove all the way to Oklahoma. So, it's nice, actually, to be sitting back in the office right now. Even though I had a great time in both states, it is nice to be back to normal. My next event that's open to the public, anyway, will be in Nashville on August 15th with Bob Murphy and David Stockman, who will be a guest on this program later this week, by the way, as early as tomorrow. I haven't worked out the schedule just yet. Find out more about that event in Nashville at nightofclarity.com. Also, this Thursday, if all goes well, I'll be hosting the Peter Schiff Show, which broadcasts Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern at schiffradio.com. Peter's on some terrestrial stations, but probably the easiest way to track him down is to listen online, which you can do for free, by the way. Sometimes people go to that site and they think they have to be a subscriber to listen. That's not true. You can listen to the live broadcast, and then that show is looped all day for free. So schiffradio.com, if you hear an ad or some ads running when you get there, don't worry, the show will be starting momentarily, 10 a.m. to noon. Thursday, I haven't worked out who the guests will be, but I do take calls, so if you've been dying to call in, now's your chance. Still working it my way into the new office here, so I need to have an electrician come in and reroute the ISDN line that I use to broadcast the Peter Schiff Show. And assuming that goes well, that's tomorrow, then I'll be able to host the show on Thursday. I'll keep you posted. All right, today I want to go through an article that I read on the website of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute and give you my critique of it. This is an article that has to do with the subject of self-ownership, which is central to at least some versions of the libertarian message anyway. Let me preface this by saying this is, of course, should go without saying that this is not intended as an attack on the Intercollegiate Studies Institute itself, with which I've had a very, very friendly relationship over the years. Just a few years ago, as a matter of fact, I published a book with them, a book of essays for which I wrote the introduction, called Back on the Road to Serfdom. And the man in charge of books at ISI was also my editor at Random House years ago when I did 33 questions about American history. So I'm good friends with those people, and a lot of the work they do is very valuable and important. So, you know, they allow students to post things on their site, post articles, and they don't, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't say Hillary Clinton is the greatest person in the world, but within a broad range, they more or less allow these students to say what they want to say. And a student by the name of Carter Skeel wrote a piece that I think it's instructive to respond to. Now, I wrote a little bit about this on my personal site, tomwoods.com, so I'm going to rely a bit on that. But then he responded to me, and I think it's very instructive what his response is. I think what's going on here is that you have a lot of conservatives who really don't know what to do about the fact that libertarianism is really, really growing, that it's spreading all over the place, that a lot of the young people they would normally appeal to are really interested now in libertarian ideas. Now, some conservatives have responded to this by saying maybe we need to give libertarians a second look. I mean, maybe we need to listen to their ideas. Maybe they can rejuvenate this movement. And some conservatives have said that, no question about it, with different levels of sincerity. But the response on the part of others has just been to fight tooth and nail against the libertarians. And so this article, The Self-Ownership Illusion, is an example of that. Now, the idea of self-ownership, I'll grant you, sounds a little bit odd to a lot of people. It's easy to understand how you can own a book or a telephone or a bottle of water or a bust of Rothbard. As you can guess, I am indeed picking out items that I'm looking at here in my office. It's easy to understand how you can own those things, but owning yourself seems sort of odd. Like, you are yourself. How do you own yourself? And when we talk about self-ownership as libertarians, what we mean by that is what we mean by any form of ownership. When you own something, you're the person who gets to control it. You are the person with the greatest moral claim in the world to control that thing. Well, this would also extend to your physical body. You have a greater moral claim to control your physical body than anybody else. And if we want to be extremely crude about it, just think of it this way. There is no appeal to the general welfare or the public good that could justify somebody in harvesting your organs against your will. Right? Nobody could say, well, look, this is an example that philosophers have used, the eye lottery. Let's suppose we had an eye lottery. And the idea was that we have all these people who can see perfectly well, but we also have a lot of blind people in society, and that's not right. So maybe what we should do is put everybody's name into a hat who has two functioning eyes. And once in a while, we draw a name out of the hat, and we say, you have been chosen in the eye lottery to give one of your eyes to a blind person. Now, let's just imagine, for the sake of argument, that giving sight to the blind is simply a matter of plucking an eye out of a sighted person and giving it to a blind person. Just for the sake of argument, suppose that's all it is. So your name is chosen. You've got two functioning eyes. They're going to take one eye away from you. And they justify it along these grounds. They say, you can see with one eye. You can't see as well with one eye. Your depth perception is shot, but you can still see. And we'll grant you that this is a decrease in your welfare, having one eye as opposed to two. We all admit that. But how can that impediment, how can that inconvenience even remotely be compared with the tremendous increase in satisfaction that the person who was once blind will have when he has your eye? And going from two eyes to one, yeah, that's a step down and that's too bad. But going from no eyes at all to one eye is such a huge step forward for somebody that it totally swamps the inconvenience that you suffer going from two eyes to one. So really we can see that everybody's welfare, or that the sum total of human welfare is increased here, because the blind person's welfare is increased by an amount greater than your welfare is decreased by the loss of the one eye. And so to bring about the public good, we're going to have an eye lottery. Now, I think even the most hardened progressive would say, you know, I'm just not willing to take public good reasoning to that extent, right? I'm not going to take it quite that far. And why is that? Because we have a certain moral intuition that if anybody's going to decide whether I should donate one of my eyes to somebody else, that should be me. I'm the person who should decide that. There's nobody else who has a moral claim to decide that. That's part of what we're talking about when we talk about self-ownership. It's not always quite that crude that we're actually talking about physical body parts, although that would be part of it. Well, likewise, a libertarian would say, if I own myself, then we can further make an argument that I can own private property. And there are different ways we justify that. We can talk about Lockean and homesteading. We can talk about a first user principle. I was the first person to use something. We obviously have to have some rule for determining who gets to own property and who gets to use things, given that there are more people with more desires than there are goods to satisfy them. So unless we want to be in a war of all against all the time, we need to establish boundary lines, and there has to be some consistent set of rules for establishing those boundary lines. And the first user principle seems to be better than any other because it's, first of all, general moral intuition. I had it first. But secondly, how could society function if we assign property on a fifth user principle? The fifth person to use something is the owner. Well, what does that mean? If I happen to have it, I can't do anything with it until a fifth person comes along? Because, of course, ownership means the right to control something. But if we say, well, you're the first person to have it, but you can't do anything with it because only the fifth person can do something with it, how would any of us be able to eat? I could be sitting there with 5 ears of corn, but I wouldn't technically have the moral right to use it because I'm not the fifth person to have it. So we'd all starve to death while we're all waiting for fifth people to run around. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So the first user principle seems to be a sensible one. Anyway, it's not my intention right now to come up with the overall libertarian justification for private property. The point is that it's a similar conclusion that libertarians draw about private property that they draw about self-ownership. That in the same way that I would have to be the one who would make the decision as to whether or not one of my eyes would be donated to a blind person, well, likewise, I should also be the one to make the decision as to whether or not any of my other property, any of my other stuff, any of my wealth is to be donated to anybody, any cause, given to anything against my will. I would decide whether or not those things should be given or not, because they belong to me. So that's the gist of self-ownership in a real nutshell. Now, Rothbard justifies and derives this idea of self-ownership in his book, The Ethics of Liberty, and he does so in large part by considering all the alternatives to self-ownership and finding that every one of them basically leads to absurdity or fails to answer the question that we're all trying to ask. There are other libertarian thinkers, of course, who don't talk about self-ownership or who will just, for example, like Ludwig von Mises, argue for the free society on utilitarian grounds. Society functions better if we're not murdering each other and if we respect private property and have all the other values we associate with classical liberalism. All right, so now having said that, let's go over, I'm going to read to you, because it's very short, I'm going to read to you this Carter Skeel article, and then we'll just go through it. So it's the article is called The Self-Ownership Illusion, and he says, well, it certainly seems like we own ourselves, but do we? For the Christian, he says, the answer is simple. As 1 Corinthians 6 teaches us, quote, or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. Then he says, since we were created by God to glorify God, we cannot claim to own ourselves. We can debate about whether we are free to choose whether or not to believe in God, but the Bible makes it clear what our claims to self-ownership are worth. Yet there is convincing evidence for the non-believer as well. Indeed, the concept of full self-ownership is misguided and dangerous. Consider a fetus. Even before she is born, she relies on another. Once she is born, she is in almost constant interaction with other human beings. It is not a stretch to say that she immediately has certain obligations to some or all of these fellow persons and they to her. She is helpless on her own. She cannot reject the help of others, even if she so desired. As she grows up, she gets a job. She might not realize it, but in doing so, she relies on public infrastructure, national defense, the international economy, and countless other things. By the way, my own editorial comment, this is a conservative speaking. by the way. You'll notice that this is Barack Obama, you didn't build that. And this is a conservative. These are the arguments a conservative has to use against libertarianism. So a conservative will be a leftist if that's what it takes to answer libertarians. All right, so continuing. Herein lies the confusion of self-ownership. It's easy to think we own ourselves and our labor on a personal level. Yet when we look at the workings of the economy, our societal relations, and the world as a whole, how can we ignore our vast interconnectedness and universal reliance on others? So many things are out of our control. Again, this is what every socialist in the world who ever lived argued exactly this way. The illusion of self-ownership eats away at the fabric of society. Without obligations to others. Now, whoa. Notice that jump. I'll give you more commentary afterward, but notice that jump. All of a sudden, he goes from self-ownership to the idea that you don't have obligations to others. So I don't have obligations to my friends to be decent and generous with them just because I own myself? That doesn't even follow. He says, without obligations to others, we become isolated rational actors. That's standard conservative criticism, that we're just isolated atoms. I've never heard any libertarian ever support something like that. Without hope for community, altruism, or morality. So you can't have morality unless you have the state. Cannot possibly have morality unless somebody is systematically stealing from you. While living in a capitalist, liberal, technologically advanced society, we act like we own ourselves and live in a state of nature. I don't even know what that means. The other extreme is flawed as well. Many theories of justice, most notably John Rawls, assume that everything we produce is part of a joint social product, which should then be divided fairly. Yet this account does not get human nature right either. While self-ownership makes everything private, these theories make everything public. And then he goes on about Rawls, which is not really to my point. What both fail to grab is the duty owed to one's place, one's community. In the first instance, we have a duty only to ourselves. In the second, to some abstract notion of society. Both fail to grasp the truth. And that's it. He stops there. So what is the truth? Blank out. We're not given an answer. What is the truth that both of us, that Rawls fails to grasp and we libertarians fail to grasp? Nothing. We don't even hear what it is. Now this whole thing that because I own myself, I don't have a duty to my community. Well, yeah, okay. I mean, they can't come and lop my head off if I don't fulfill my duty, I suppose. But that doesn't mean that I don't have any. That doesn't mean that I might not, you know, if my neighbor's house burns down, I might not have a moral obligation to try and help them out if I possibly can. That has nothing whatsoever to do with self-ownership. Why would it? Why would that have anything whatsoever to do with self-ownership? And of course, when I do live in a community, there are a lot of communities where there are written understandings. These are the rules that we all follow in this community. In this community, you don't paint your house hot pink because that would annoy everybody else. And if you don't like that rule, then you live in a community where you do like the rules. I mean, that's how civilized people interact with each other. You don't put a gun in people's ribs and say, you will follow the dictates of the collective. All right, so let's go through what I actually wrote here in response, and I'll add some additional commentary. I said, first of all, to believe in self-ownership has nothing to do with thinking that we have obligations only to ourselves. By that reasoning, all property ownership would be antisocial and evil, and now you're in Rousseau land. You're a conservative. You don't want to end up in Rousseau land. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who thought that property itself was a crime. Likewise, saying that I have a property right in my savings account does not mean that all I care about is my savings account. Because he's saying that if you believe in self-ownership, that means that you only have obligations to yourself. Well, I also believe in private property ownership. Does that mean that all I care about is my private property? Like, that is a jump, a logical leap that makes no sense. There's no justification for that. This is what leftists say about conservatives, and now I'm reading an alleged conservative saying it about libertarians. Now, for the Christian, which is the appeal he makes at the beginning, God owns absolutely everything, not just your physical body. So according to the logic of this article, therefore, we can't lay claim to any physical thing, whether bodies or houses or books or anything else, since God owns it all. The point is that vis-a-vis other human beings, we are the owners or stewards of particular property and of our physical bodies. And again, when we say that we own ourselves, we mean that we have the right to control what is ours. No other person has a better moral claim to control my physical body than I do. Or do you dispute this? And the writer says, I rely on the, quote, international economy. Therefore, I don't own myself. That makes no sense. By this logic, I could not legitimately own any property because this critic would come along and say, hey, man, you rely on police, courts, civil society, the existence of language for you to enjoy that property. Therefore, your so-called property rights are a myth. Does he see the slippery slope he's on here? And it's not really a slippery slope. I shouldn't even say that because sometimes people use slippery slope arguments unjustly. But here, it's not even a slippery slope. He is making the leftist argument. And I point out, does that mean, incidentally, that if the international economy should need one of my eyes or both of my ears, that I couldn't legitimately complain? So it's all well and good to say that God owns all bodies, but we're going to need some kind of guidance for the here and now as to who is allowed to do what to whom. So simply dismissing self-ownership with a Bible verse is not helpful in this task. But the rest of the article is even worse. Nobody denies that we all benefit from centuries of capital accumulation, from the existence of the division of labor, and from various other institutions to which we have not ourselves contributed. That's true. However, this again is a leftist argument that leads to the total state. Leftists and even most conservative economists, to their eternal shame, claim that the utterly confused and incoherent concept of public goods requires the state to expropriate peaceful people. Why, you are enjoying the benefit of X without contributing to it. Well, we've talked about the fallacies of public goods on this program twice with Jeff Herbener and with Fred Foldvery. I recommend the article by Hans Hermann Hoppe, on public goods, which you can Google. But this article takes public goods logic to a ludicrous extreme. Whether or not other people have done important things, like people have built roads for us, so therefore all my accomplishments are not mine because I had to drive on roads that other people built, that has nothing to do with whether I own myself. I don't see why the guy can't say, yeah, you own yourself, but maybe the fruits of your labor aren't entirely your own because you couldn't do them without roads other people have built. I mean, he could at least make that argument. But it has nothing to do with whether or not I own myself that somebody built a road. So you're saying if nobody built any roads that maybe we could claim that we own ourselves? This doesn't even make sense. There is no sense to this at all. And I'm afraid the student is a philosophy student. Oh, yikes. Yikes. I would read a lot more before I start my writing career. So this is a complete non sequitur. Whether or not we need the government's crummy roads, which we're in turn forced to pay for, is irrelevant to this question. So it's not enough that I have to pay for road socialism, as Walter Block calls it. My consequent reliance on those roads is then to be used against me to claim I don't own myself? Am I reading Intercollegiate Review or the New Left Review? So anyway, that was the gist of what I said. So then he responds and says this. With all due respect, sir, I think your response relies on taking my claims to absurd and fallacious conclusions. Am I? Where? Where? Give me a specific example. Well, he tries to give one. He says, I am not saying that with a property right in your savings account, all you care about is your savings account. Yes, you are saying that. Yes, you are. Because you just said that if I believe that I own myself, then I only care about myself. What is the leap to say that if you believe that if I own my savings account, then all I care about is my savings account and I don't care about other people? He thinks if I believe in self-ownership, then I don't care about and have no obligations toward other people. That the only obligations I can have are ones that are violently enforced, apparently. So then he says, rather, I'm saying that you don't deserve all that's in your savings account. So now he's making it worse. I'm saying you don't deserve all that's in your savings account, parentheses, assuming you're a libertarian world. And the reason you don't deserve all of it is that you needed help to get where you are. So not everything that helped you get where you are was a free market transaction of goods and services. Now, I mean, think about the logical conclusion of this. I mean, think about all the things people do that make my life possible. I mean, I could make all my own clothes. I could. And it would take all day and all night for me because I have no idea what I'm doing. But instead, somebody else makes those clothes for me. And when I give them $5 for a T-shirt, could you imagine how much that's really worth to me. You think of the hours it would take me to go from raw materials to a finished shirt. Think of how much those hours are worth to me financially. Way more than $5. So, I mean, the next thing he's going to claim is that really the $5 shirt, even that, even though that was a legitimate market transaction, even that, in a way, I don't fully deserve. Like, really, the only way I could fully deserve things is to live in complete isolation as a hermit. And then I could deserve the baskets that I weave, I suppose, and that would be it. Now, of course, in a market society where roads and whatever else are provided privately, well, those people have already been compensated. Those people have been compensated for that road. Those people have been compensated for the hospitals that they built and that they staff and that they administer. They've already been compensated for that. And I myself, in one form or another, have compensated them for that already. So to say that even though I've compensated them for those things, I still am not entitled to my savings account. What am I, just in indefinite perpetual serfdom to road builders and infrastructure builders? In the free market, these would be privately supplied, and they would earn the same normal rate of return that any other investment earns. So if you're going to say that because there are roads, therefore I'm not entitled to what's in my savings account, you'd have to say that about every single good in the economy. Because roads are not in any way conceptually different. They're not categorically different from all other goods that would be produced in a purely private property economy. Right? They're not any different. They're just things that people do to earn a profit. And you can earn profit on roads in various ways. And once you put your money in the toll booth or whatever, you have fulfilled your obligation. But to say, well, you don't really own your savings account because on top of what you pay in tolls, you have to forever be paying some serfdom fee or something. No, once the transaction is complete, they've done their job and I've done my job. And even things that have been there for a long time, if we're going to say that, look, that sewer system was there, was built a long time before you were born, you didn't have to pay for that. But look, all capital accumulation that's gone on from the beginning of time to now, I had nothing to do with. But if you argue that way, that anything that you didn't have anything directly to do with, therefore you, means that you can't lay claim to your savings account, then nobody can lay claim to anything. Because people like this will go around arbitrarily declaring that, you know what, I think we'll say your fee for the service mankind did you in capital accumulation over the centuries is 38% of your income, and then the fee for the roads will be, and of course it's a coercive institution that gets to decide what the fee will be, right? The institution that will get paid this fee, namely the state, gets to decide how much I owe. You don't see any potential for abuse here. All right, let's carry on here. I got to finish this up here. He says, not everything helped you get where you are was a free market transaction of goods and services. And I don't want to live in a world where everything's a free market transaction. Very little that makes this world we live in livable stems from a free market transaction. Boy, we should throw this guy in the middle of the jungle and see just how many free market transactions it takes to get from primitivism to civilization. Then he says, what would individuals look like, families look like, and communities look like in this world? Well, so he thinks that self-ownership means that in families, we would all be contracting with each other. Like, I'll make a contract with my children. Look, I'll be your dad up to this point, and the rules are, you know, you do this chore, and I'll give you this. He thinks everything would be a contract. Why would he think? All we're saying is don't commit violence against anybody. That's all we're saying. Don't commit violence against anybody is all we're saying. And from that, from the absence of the state or the drastic limiting of the state, he takes that to mean that families would have to be run on a contract and non-love basis. It's unbelievable how the state has, I'm sorry to use this word, but brainwashed people. What other explanation is there for why he thinks families can't be based on love if you have self-ownership? I don't understand that at all. What would individuals look like? Well, they'd have a lot more dignity, that's for sure, instead of thinking that they are the pawns of somebody else who's going to arbitrarily bill them for all the 8 million things that in the world that they didn't create, and then send them a bill. Yeah, we already have those bills. We get them in the mail. We pay them. And then what would communities look like? Well, communities would be sorted along the lines of what do you find livable? Where would you like to live? I'd like to live in a community, let's say, of a lot of like-minded people. You could do that in a free society. You could live anywhere you wanted. And for him, this is like a nightmare scenario to him. Because he thinks that we would all be atoms, isolated atoms, and we would never cooperate with each other. We'd never get together to donate, to build a park or something, unless there's a gun in the ribs. What an awful way to think about the world. I mean, what a depressing view of the world. Without that gun in the ribs, kids, you ain't getting that swing set. I mean, really? Just because we believe in no violence, he thinks that we'll all just be shriveled up atoms? Well, speak for yourself. Then he says, where is love between people? So without the state, there's no love. He actually says it. There's no love. If you don't want to commit violence against people, there's no love. And then he says, I also don't understand where obligations derive from on this account. Are they simply obligations not to harm? Well, yes, legally, they're obligations not to harm. But you have many, many other moral obligations that you have that go beyond the realm of politics. That's all. Then he says, the truth is you do rely on countless things beyond your control. You rely on the international economy not crashing, our country not being taken over, and generations of non-libertarian-minded people before you. Okay, well, I don't think I rely on those people, at least in terms of spreading ideas. But yeah, again, they did work, but they were paid for that work. They've already been compensated for that. So to say that I am in perpetual serfdom because other people built, I don't know, shoe stores or built parks, I'm in perpetual serfdom to this, is an avenue to the total state. He says, I'm not arguing for a total state. I know you're not. I know you don't think you are. But that's where your reasoning inevitably goes. That is exactly where it goes. And you rely on the international economy not crashing. So does he favor ending the Fed, I hope? I don't see any acknowledgement of that. But again, the international economy crashing is not some spontaneous occurrence. So he thinks there's like some public infrastructure that keeps the international economy from crashing. Read about the Austrian theory of the business cycle and then come back to me. Our country not being taken over. So again, I rely on the U.S. military. That's a whole other show. Bob Murphy and I talked about how you might actually deal with a problem like that without taxation, without institutionalized violence. That's a whole separate show. That's why we did a whole separate show on that. But he says the right will never be successful as long as it reflexively opposes any and all government. Rather, we should oppose bad government and extol good government. Now, I forgive him because he's young. And I'm sure there was a time that I believed that. We just need good public policy. We need good public policy. That's what we need. I think you need to listen to this show, frankly, to disabuse you of this sort of notion. We just need good people. We need good policies. Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. But, you know, again, I don't want to say that this guy's adult. He's not adult. You know, I mean, he's got some ideas that are pretty conventional. And he's got ideas that maybe a lot of us believed in at one time in our lives or another, until somebody came along and shook us out of it. Well, this is your wake-up call, Carter Skeel. This is your wake-up call. Think differently. You can have love without violence, I promise. All right, everybody, that's it for today. If you like this show, there are two ways you can help me promote it and help me pay the bills around here. One, at no cost to yourself, when you're about to make that Amazon purchase, think to yourself, who's that guy who keeps giving me a free show every day? And head over to TomWoodsRadio.com and enter Amazon from there. Secondly, you can become the awesomest person in the world by being a supporting listener of the show. I have got so many goodies lined up for you guys this year at various levels of supporting listeners. Everybody gets transcripts of all the interviews. You get discounts at the Mises store and a bunch of other Liberty stores. 60% off at my libertyclassroom.com. It's like AAA. It pays for itself if you know how to use it right. I'm going to be throwing in other things. My book that's coming out, I assume later this year. I'll be giving that to the supporting listeners. It's just going to be non-stop, just stuff, like all kinds of stuff coming. You can support me over at supportinglisteners.com. We're going to shoot for David Stockman, former budget director under Ronald Reagan, tomorrow on this show. So let's see if that works out. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.